You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's passage is often heard as the classic Christmas passage, often heard on the lips of Linus in A Charlie Brown Christmas. And while we'd like to think this is history exactly as it happened, it's better put in the category of a good story. Remember, Luke may have been written as early as the 80s of the first century, but a growing minority opinion has Luke being written as late as 120 of the Common Era. So, with Jesus' birth having been recalculated at about 6 BCE, that puts Luke having been written anywhere from 90 to nearly 130 years after the fact. So, lots of room for embellishment in that amount of time. Also, don't forget that Luke and Matthew have totally different settings, storylines, and even the cast of characters is different. Matthew has the family living in Bethlehem, where they don't have to travel anywhere for the birth. But Luke has the down-and-out family traveling from Nazareth to Bethlehem. And today's scene is set in essentially an undisclosed location. Some depictions set the story in a cave. Why? Because that's where the infancy gospel of Thomas sets the story. Most nativity scenes are set in a stable, but Luke doesn't really say. We just know that there's a manger, which is just a fancy word for a feeding trough, which in Jesus' day was often hewn out of stone. So we assume there are animals somewhere around, but none are mentioned. What we can't assume is that it was in a stable. Most Palestinian homes in the first century were pretty compact, and folks couldn't afford a separate building for animals, so the animals would be brought inside the house on the first floor, and the family would sleep in a loft over the animals. This arrangement kept the animals secure and safe in the winter, made for added warmth, and in the summer, the family would sleep in the cool of the night on their flat roof. Luke's spiritual agenda is clear. More than any of the other Gospels, Luke emphasizes the place of the poor, the outcast, and women in Jesus' life. So it shouldn't be surprising that right before our passage is the story of the cousins, Mary and Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. Then, right after our passage, is the story of the shepherds, the poorest of the poor in Jesus' day. So, however you end up imagining the location of this passage, be it a cave or a stable or in someone's animal pen below their sleeping loft, be sure to picture pretty meager surroundings.
Our words of wisdom are from Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. About that time, Caesar Augustus ordered a census to be taken throughout the empire. This was the first census when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Everyone had to travel to his own ancestral hometown to be accounted for. So Joseph went from the Galilean town of Nazareth up to Bethlehem in Judah, David's town, for the census.
As a descendant of David, he had to go there. He went with Mary, his fiancée, who was pregnant. While they were there, the time came for her to give birth. She gave birth to a son, her firstborn. She wrapped him in a blanket and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Back in 1985, right before the Palestinian uprising known as the First Intifada, I had the opportunity to travel with other students to Jerusalem. I was especially excited to learn that our schedule was free over the Christmas holiday. Our dorm was in a neighborhood on the south side of Jerusalem and just a few miles from Bethlehem, so several of us set off to visit Manger Square on Christmas Eve. Mind you, we had no idea that this would be no small feat. It involved taking a bus away from Bethlehem into Jerusalem, where we could then go through metal detectors, be patted down, and only then get in line for a bus pass. Once on the bus, armed Israeli Defense Force guards with Uzis jumped on board as escorts. And I must have looked alarmed to have an Uzi dangling in my face, because one of the young soldiers laughed and reassured me in his best English, "Commando bus," which did not make me feel any better. At any rate, we rode the couple of miles to Bethlehem without incident, and we tumbled off the bus only to face more lines to go through more metal detectors and pat-downs before we could even get into Manger Square. And once we managed to make it through all the security, we were confronted with a mass of noisy, jostling humanity, the likes of which is hard to describe. It was a united nations of people, all crammed into what is a relatively small space, with various choirs competing to outsing one another in their own languages, all surrounded by Israeli Rat Patrol jeeps with those large caliber machine guns mounted on the back. In what seemed like a throwback to the 60s, a couple of young people were going around putting daisies in the barrels of Israeli machine guns. To be clear, none of us outside were among the privileged few who had tickets to actually be in the Church of the Nativity for the Christmas Eve service. That was reserved for only the religious aristocracy, socialites, and elite politicians, as Jesus would have wanted. Suffice it to say, the whole thing was surreal. And as it was not like anything any of us expected, my companions and I gave up on Bethlehem for Christmas Eve. We stumbled out onto Manger Street and hailed a cab back to our South Jerusalem neighborhood. Once there, we stopped into a little bodega for our Christmas Eve dinner, pineapple pizza, which is kosher, of course. As the whole Bethlehem scene had left us a little wanting, we decided to take a walk. And as we were on the southern edge of Jerusalem, we were soon out walking by only the moonlight in the fields between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. The lights of Jerusalem's suburbs were on one horizon, Bethlehem off in the distance. We walked in silence till we came to these large concrete outcroppings, which turned out to be bunkers and a trench complex from the 67 war. We climbed up and sat in the cool of the evening on top of a dilapidated pillbox, which to this day stands guard over the dividing line between Jews and Palestinians. We sat there watching the stars go by and soaking up the ironies of the night. The next year, another group of friends was in Bethlehem for Christmas Eve and brought pictures back of the giant inflatable Santa Claus dominating Manger Square. By 2000, tensions were so high, Christmas in Bethlehem was canceled altogether. Too dangerous. And by 2002, in a show of force in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, tanks sat in Manger Square. The fact of the matter is, even if you're right where the story says it happened, it's hard to see the manger anymore. There's so much in the way. What chance does a baby in a manger have against politics, religious competition, commercialism, violence, greed, ignorance, and brutal, corrupt governments. It's not a fair fight. And yet, I think it can be argued that no single life has changed the world more, for good and for ill, than the life of that one baby that our tradition says was born in Bethlehem a couple of thousand years ago. A life that challenges people, even now, to look beyond the way the world is, to see the way the world could be. Rest assured, we don't have to go all the way to Bethlehem to be disappointed with the way life is. It happens to so many every day in too many ways to count. Systemic injustice, failing health, financial crises, broken relationships. So I'm convinced that there's a reason why Christmas has got a deeper meaning for even the most non-religious people. Hope for something better. But there's more to Advent than the pursuit of personal peace. In this time of preparation for Christmas, we're also challenged. Challenged to be a witness to the influence of this Jesus character on our lives, and to witness to the world about what this Emmanuel is up to. Back in the early 90s, the Berlin Wall had just come down, and there were glimmers of change in the former USSR. Two Americans were invited by the Russian Department of Education to teach morals and ethics in their prisons, at their businesses, in fire and police departments, and at least one large orphanage. They were told that they should feel free to teach from their perspective and their faith. So they went. When they arrived at the orphanage, they discovered about 100 boys and girls who had been abandoned, abused, and left in the care of an inadequate government-run program. It was the holiday season, and many of the orphans wanted to hear, some of them for the first time, their traditional story of Christmas. One of the Americans said, "We told them about Mary and Joseph arriving in Bethlehem, finding no room in the inn. The couple went to a stable where the baby Jesus was born and placed in a manger. Throughout the story, the children and orphanage staff sat in rapt attention, anxious for the translator to keep up. Some sat on the edges of their stools, trying to grasp every word. At the end of the story, they gave each of the children three small pieces of cardboard so they could make a crude manger. Then each child was given a small piece of yellow paper cut from napkins. There was no colored paper available in the city. Following instructions, the children tore the paper and carefully laid the strips in the manger for straw. Small squares of flannel cut from a worn-out nightgown were used for the baby's blanket. A doll-like baby was cut from tan felt that the teachers had brought with them. One of the teachers recalls, "The children were busy assembling their mangers as I walked among them to see if any of them needed help. And everything was going well until I got to one table where little Misha sat. And he looked to be about 6 years old and had finished his project. As I looked at the little boy's nativity scene, I was startled to see not one, but two felt babies in the manger. I called the translator over to ask the boy why there were two babies in the manger. Crossing his arms in front of himself and looking at his completed manger scene, the child began to repeat the story very seriously. For such a young boy who had heard the Christmas story exactly, I don't know, once, he related the happenings accurately. Until he came to the part where Mary put the baby Jesus into the manger. Then Misha started to ad lib. He made up his own ending to the story as he said, 'And when Mary laid the baby in the manger, Jesus looked at me and asked me if I had a place to stay. I told him, I don't have any place to stay because I have no mama and no papa. Then Jesus told me I could stay with him. But I told him I couldn't because I didn't have a gift to bring him like everybody else did. But I wanted to stay with Jesus so much. So I thought about it, what I had that maybe I could use for a gift. So I asked Jesus, if I keep you warm, will that be a good enough gift? And Jesus told me, if you keep me warm, that will be the best gift anybody ever gave me. So I just looked at Jesus and climbed into the manger. And he told me that I could stay with him for always. At this time of year, we refer to Jesus as Emmanuel, which literally means God with us. That's what this incarnation thing is all about. And I love that the word incarnation is such a visceral word. If you know any Spanish, you know that carne literally means meat, as in chili con carne, with meat. Carne has the same root as incarnation, in the flesh, with meat. And that's what we're called to do as followers of Jesus, to put meat on Jesus' message, to make it real in the world. But we have to be extra careful at this time of year. Our tendency is to make Christmas into a sweet saccharine story about the hope we feel at the birth of a baby. But at the heart of both Luke and Matthew's stories are complex political and systemic injustices bearing down on the poor and disadvantaged. And like Misha, we're called to be manger rearrangers, called to put ourselves into the story, to make a difference in the world. And if we're going to actually live a life that seeks the justice that Jesus sought and put love first, then it may require more than just passive warmth and our presence. The religious discrimination and political injustices that led to the tensions I experienced in Bethlehem are still unresolved over 35 years later. And the complex reality of seeking peace on earth means that we have to actively work against the attitudes and systems that promote hate and injustice in the world. My friend and Beth Dyer's cousin, Mark Davies, preached here a few years ago. He recently wrote, "We cannot be fully for something unless we are also against the systems that keep what we are for from coming into reality. We cannot simply all get along with each other when some of us are supporting systems and beliefs that are unjust and harming others. Getting along with each other in that context would be perpetuating the injustice and harm. If we say we are for racial justice, but we do nothing to work against the systems that perpetuate racial injustice, then we really are not for racial justice. We cannot be for the poor without being against the economic systems that exploit them. We cannot be for the liberation of the oppressed without being against those who oppress them." Look, in its misguided idolization of unity, our United Methodist denomination has lurched along for a generation, trying to be both for and against the same things. We said we were for the inclusion of all people, but we were against actually including all people. So I say good riddance to all those soon-to-be former United Methodists who, in excluding our LGBTQ brothers and sisters, betray Jesus' core message. Like Misha, we need to be creative in being manger rearrangers. Some might say, but he's not sticking to the story. So, Misha was working with what he had, which was nothing. And like him, some of us know what it's like to have that hound of nothingness at our doors. Broken relationships, shattered expectations, crippled finances or health, a struggle for meaning. But even with nothing, Misha had himself to give. And all of us have at least that. And in this season of over-sentimentalized schlock, we can find purpose in being manger rearrangers, of taking that passion for love and justice in our hearts and make it sacred, make it real. To paraphrase the German priest Angelus Silesius, if in your heart you make a manger for its birth, the sacred will once again become real on earth. The world is full of hurt, anxiety, and mistrust, be it in our personal challenges of life or the big picture injustices of the system in which we live. With the circus of what happens, even in modern Bethlehem, it's easy to lose track of that manger. And yet each one of us, in our own unique way, is challenged to bring the sacred to birth, keeping Jesus' vision alive, like Misha, sharing who we are. So whenever we steel ourselves to hold back the cold of hate, prejudice, injustice, anxiety, or apathy, we are keeping that ember of Jesus' vision warm. Yeah, sometimes it could be as simple as being present, but other times it means seriously rearranging things. Our commitments and our actions can show the world the real good news, that the kingdom of God is here, it's now, and the best gift that we can ever offer is the gift of ourselves, our presence, and our passion for putting love first in the world. Even if it means disrupting the status quo by rising to the challenge of being manger rearrangers. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.